The human brain is a machine for coming to conclusions. If it cannot come to conclusions, it is rusty. When we hear of a man too clever to believe, it is like hearing of a nail that is too good to hold down a carpet, or a bolt that is too strong to keep a door shut. Man can be defined as an animal that makes dogmas, as he piles doctrine on doctrine and conclusion on conclusion in the formation of some philosophy or religion. It makes him more and more human. When, on the other hand, he drops one doctrine after another in a refined skepticism, when he declines to tie himself to a system, when he holds no creed but claims to be contemplating all, then he is, by that very process, sinking slowly backwards into the vagueness of the vagrant animals and the unconsciousness of the grass. And trees have no dogmas. And turnips are singularly broad-minded.
If you're a turnip, you may not be interested in reading G.K. Chesterton. But if you have a brain and like the idea of using it to come to conclusions, Chesterton is just right for you. Hello, I'm Dale Alquist, and welcome to the Apostle of Common Sense, a series of programs where we explore the words and wisdom of the great English writer G.K. Chesterton. Heretics is one of Chesterton's most important books. It's also, for some reason, one of his most neglected books. Perhaps the reason has to do with the title. The word heretic conjures up frightful images of controversial characters being barbecued for their beliefs. It smacks of intolerance. The very word dogmatic is perceived as being intolerant. But as Chesterton says, man is the animal who makes dogmas. You could say that man is a religious animal. There's something ironic about the ideal of tolerance or so-called religious freedom. It has done more to suppress religion than has any persecution. It has left us not only afraid to debate about our beliefs, it has made us afraid even to discuss them. As Chesterton says, we now talk about the weather and call it the complete liberty of all creeds. This strange silence about religion leaves the impression that religion is not important.
There is one thing that is infinitely more absurd and unpractical than burning a man for his philosophy. This is the habit of seeing that his philosophy does not matter. And this is done universally in the 20th century. A man's opinion on Botticelli matters. His opinion on all things does not matter.
Chesterton says that we can't get away from the fact that we have a general view of existence, whether we like it or not. And it affects and involves everything we say or do, whether we like it or not. And our general view of things is based on our ultimate view of things. Religion is never irrelevant. It not only deals with ultimate things, but everything else. It is important to note that Chesterton's book is not an attack, but a defense of the ancient truths that are under attack by modern heretics. Chesterton claims to have gained a deeper appreciation of the Christian faith through the simple exercise of defending it.
We who are Christians never knew the great philosophic common sense which inheres in that mystery until the anti-Christian writers pointed it out to us.
Common sense. The Christian faith is common sense. Heresy, it turns out, is usually a distinct lack of common sense. A heresy is at best a half-truth, but usually even less than that. A heresy is a fragment of the truth that is exaggerated at the expense of the rest of the truth. For instance, freedom is good, but that doesn't mean obedience is bad. Sobriety is good, but that doesn't mean wine is bad. Sacrifice is good, but that doesn't mean pleasure is bad. Reason is good, but that doesn't mean faith is bad. In the Catholic faith, we recognize that a heresy is not so much a false doctrine as an incomplete doctrine. It has rejected part of the truth and is representing what's left over as the whole truth. But what the heretic usually ends up doing is attacking the greater truth. The reason why Chesterton is an apostle of common sense is because he is a complete thinker. The reason he could recognize heresy is because he could expose incomplete thinking. Surprisingly, Chesterton wrote Heretics before he became a Catholic. Although he defends the Christian faith generally, he's already defending Catholic doctrine specifically. The completeness of his thought is already apparent. For instance, he gives a very Catholic response to the heresy that strong societies can only be established by strong men.
When Christ, at a symbolic moment, was establishing his great society, he chose for its cornerstone neither the brilliant Paul nor the mystic John, but a shuffler, snob, a coward, in a word, a man, Peter. And upon this rock he has built his church, and the gates of hell have not prevailed against it. All the empires and the kingdoms have failed because of this inherent and continual weakness, that they were founded by strong men and upon strong men. But this one thing, the historic Christian church, was founded on a weak man, and for that reason it is indestructible, for no chain is stronger than its weakest link.
The so-called heretics that Chesterton writes about in this book were his philosophical and political opponents, people like George Bernard Shaw and H.G. Wells. Chesterton treats them with fairness and geniality. He points out what is good in their argument before pointing out what is fatally wrong with their argument. His geniality is as great as his genius. But we should not underestimate his courage and his confidence. He is, after all, going up against the leading thinkers of the day and telling them that they're wrong and why they are wrong. The list of personalities includes Shaw and Wells and other well-known names, along with some names that are probably no longer familiar. But all the heresies are familiar, especially to the modern world, which praises science and hygiene and success and progress. These are all very well and good, but they have been elevated at the expense of larger truths, such as faith, tradition, humility, and lasting ideals. These larger truths lie at the heart of Christianity. Chesterton says that Christianity better understands man's needs than any modern philosophy or economic system or political scheme or social policy. Christianity may be an ideal, but the Christian mystic, says Chesterton, is the most practical man of all. He does the right thing for the right reason. The heretic may occasionally do the right thing for the wrong reason, but doing things for the right reason, says Chesterton, is always jollier.
A young man may keep himself from vice by continually thinking of disease, or he may keep himself from it by continually thinking of the Virgin Mary. There may be question about which method is the more reasonable, or even about which is the more efficient. But surely there can be no question about which is the more wholesome.
Chesterton is usually able to use the heretics' own arguments against them. As he says, it was the anti-Christian writers who pointed out all the common sense in Christianity. In the same way, it is often the agnostics and the scoffers who provide some of the best evidence for the very existence of God. For example, says Chesterton, blasphemy is based on belief. The blasphemer cannot achieve any artistic effect unless he is at heart a believer. If anyone doubts this, says Chesterton, let him sit down and seriously try to think some blasphemous thoughts about Thor. Likewise, he shows that the skepticism of the skeptic is his own undoing. The agnostic, who cannot make up his mind about anything, will still maintain that he can see the good in everything because of his open-mindedness. But Chesterton says it is ludicrous to suppose that the more skeptical we are, the more we see good in everything. Rather, the more we are certain what good is, the more we shall see good in everything. We have to have some conviction of the truth in order to see the good. But it can't be an idiosyncratic truth. It has to be a shared truth. In other words, it has to be common sense. It's no great praise to say of some eccentric intellectual, "He knows his own mind." Chesterton says that's like saying, "He blows his own nose." Let's take a look at how Chesterton deals with a few of the modern heresies. First up, progress. How can anybody be against progress? Well, the problem with progress, Chesterton points out, is that it doesn't mean anything. You cannot have progress unless you have established what your goal is. Progress itself cannot be a goal. Progress cannot be an ideal. Chesterton says the word is simply a comparative of which we have not settled the superlative.
Nobody has any business using the word progress unless he has a definite creed and a cast iron code of morals. Nobody can be progressive without first being doctrinal. For progress, by its very name, indicates a direction. And the moment we are in the least doubtful about the direction, we become in the same degree doubtful about the progress. Never, perhaps, since the beginning of the world, has there been an age that had less right to use the word progress than ours. In the Catholic 12th century, in the philosophic 18th century, the direction may have been a good one or a bad one. Men may have differed more or less about how far they went and in what direction. But about the direction, they did in the main agree, and consequently, they had the genuine sensation of progress. But it is precisely about the direction that we disagree. Whether the future excellence lies in more law or less law, in more liberty or less liberty, whether property will be finally concentrated or finally cut up, whether sexual passion will reach its sanest in an almost virgin intellectualism or in a full animal freedom, whether we should love everybody with Tolstoy or spare nobody with Nietzsche. These are the things about which we are actually fighting most.
Next, science. What's wrong with science? Nothing. Science is good, as far as it can go. But there are some places that science cannot go. It cannot go into the soul. It cannot explain human nature. If someone does try to use science to explain human nature, that is a misuse of science. It is vain to try to explain the soul in materialistic terms. It is also dangerous. To deny the reality of the spiritual world has far-reaching ramifications in the material world. As Chesterton says, take away the supernatural, and what remains is the unnatural. Chesterton criticizes the very idea that if we scientifically study primitive cultures, we can then understand our own culture. That if we examine tribal beliefs, we can then scientifically uncover the basis for our religion.
If a man desires to find out the origins of religions, let him not go to the Sandwich Islands. Let him go to church. We do not understand the savage for the same reason that the savage does not understand himself. And the savage does not understand himself for the same reason that we do not understand ourselves either. The moment any matter has passed through the human mind, it has become a thing incurably mysterious and infinite. Even what we call material desires are really spiritual, because they are human.
Oh, yes, science can analyze a pork chop. And science can say how much of it is phosphorus and how much of it is protein. But science cannot analyze any man's wish for a pork chop and say how much of it is hunger, how much of custom, how much nervous fancy, how much a haunting love of the beautiful. A man's desire for pork chop remains literally as mystical and ethereal as his desire for heaven. All attempts, therefore, at a science of any human thing, at a science of history, a science of folklore, a science of sociology, are by their nature not merely hopeless, but crazy.
Next up, paganism. Modern heretics think themselves quite clever in saying that paganism is superior to Christianity, and they even imagine themselves able to be pagans. But Chesterton shows that not only was paganism something different from what moderns think it was, it was something much less than the Christianity which replaced it. Modern intellectuals, by pretending to be pagans, only show how narrow they are.
The real difference between paganism and Christianity is perfectly summed up in the difference between what we call the pagan or natural virtues, such as justice and temperance, and those three virtues of Christianity which the Church of Rome calls virtues of grace: faith, hope, and charity. First of all, the pagan virtues, such as justice and temperance, are the sad virtues, while the mystical virtues of faith, hope, and charity are the happy, even exuberant virtues. Secondly, the pagan virtues are the reasonable virtues, while the Christian virtues of faith, hope, and charity are unreasonable. Justice consists in finding out a certain thing due to a certain man and giving it to him. Temperance consists in finding out the proper limit of a particular indulgence and adhering to that. But charity means pardoning what is unpardonable, or it is no virtue at all. Hope means helping when things are hopeless, or it is no virtue at all. And faith means believing the incredible, or it is no virtue at all.
As we said earlier, Heretics is a book that defends good things much more than it attacks bad things. And there's one chapter in the book that is truly marvelous. In fact, one observer has said it is the quintessential Chesterton essay, that if we could only keep one piece of his writing and everything else that Chesterton ever wrote were to be burned or buried, this is the chapter we should keep. In this chapter, Chesterton defends the institution which is most under attack today, the family. Chesterton calls the family the ultimate human institution. If we can get along in a family, we can get along in other lesser human institutions like neighborhoods or cities or countries.
It is a good thing for a man to live in a family, for the same reason that it is a good thing for a man to be besieged in a city. It is a good thing for a man to live in a family in the same sense that it is a beautiful and delightful thing for a man to be snowed in. Both situations force him to realize that life is not a thing from outside, but a thing from inside. Life, if it is to be truly stimulating and fascinating, is a thing which, of its nature, exists in spite of ourselves. The modern writers, who have suggested that the family is a bad institution, have generally confined themselves to suggesting, with much sharpness, bitterness, or pathos, that perhaps the family is not always very congenial. Of course, the family is a good institution, because it is uncongenial. It is wholesome, precisely because it contains so many divergencies and varieties. It is, as the sentimentalists say, like a little kingdom. And like most other little kingdoms, it is generally in a state of something resembling anarchy. The men and women who, for good reasons and bad, revolt against the family are, for good reasons and bad, simply revolting against mankind. Aunt Elizabeth is unreasonable, like mankind. Papa is excitable, like mankind. Our youngest brother is mischievous, like mankind. Grandpa is stupid, like the world. He is old, like the world. Those who wish, rightly or wrongly, to step out of all this, do definitely wish to step into a narrower world. They are dismayed and terrified by the largeness and variety of the family. I do not say for a moment that the flight to this narrower life may not be the right thing for the individual, any more than I say the same thing about flight into a monastery. But I do say that anything is bad and artificial which tends to make people succumb to the strange delusion that they are stepping into a world which is actually larger and more varied than their own. The best way that a man could test his readiness to encounter the common variety of mankind would be to climb down a chimney into any house at random and get on as well as possible with the people inside. That, I should think, is essentially what each one of us did on the day that we were born.
Chesterton says the supreme adventure is being born. When we step into the world, it is like stepping into a splendid and startling trap. It is something we do not expect. When we step into a family, we step into a fairy tale. It is romantic, fantastic, colorful, and sometimes hardly believable. And like a fairy tale, it is a story. And if there is a story, there is a storyteller. Each day is a new chapter. And, says Chesterton, in the fiery alphabet of every sunset is written, to be continued in our next. I'm Dale Alquist. Join us again on The Apostle of Common Sense.